The Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. It takes a certain kind of brave to run a business. We see it, we back it.
Well, our next guest spotted a niche in the market at the start of the first lockdown. Ollie Kavanagh set up Strike, a system for tipping people when you're not carrying any cash. It applies to hospitality, obviously, but also the charity sector. Ollie, was there a particular moment where the idea came to you?
There were lots of situations, but actually the tipping point, if you will, was at the time my office was in Balls Bridge. Full lockdown had happened, so all the pubs were closed, everywhere was closed. But we found out that one of the pubs was doing deliveries. If you called a certain number, they would actually deliver pints.
Draft pints, the real pints.
Yeah, to your home or office. And so on a Friday, we called in half a dozen pints of Guinness, and 15 minutes later, this poor guy arrived panting and sweating with this big, heavy wooden tray with holes cut out of it for pints so that they wouldn't fall over. And he'd walked probably 400 metres down the street with us. And I thought, gosh, if anyone's earned the tip, it's this guy. And I couldn't tip him. Half an hour later, he was back with another six pints. And I said, look, I'm really sorry, I can't tip you. And he said, look, it's all right, no one's tipping. No one carries cash anymore. And I said to the other people I was with, surely someone's got a couple of euro. No one had any cash. And in the next half an hour between that conversation and the next delivery, I thought there's got to be something that this guy could either wear or carry, even if it was a card or a wristband or a badge that we could just tap. And I said to him when he came back, I said, if there was something that you could wear that we could just tap and give you a euro, would you use it? He said, God, of course, absolutely. And I thought, this is really, there's an opportunity here. Something, someone is going to do this if I don't do it. I did a bit of research, and it was happening around the world. It wasn't just an Irish thing. And I reckoned there were probably at least 60 million people in English speaking countries who were affected by this, people who rely on tips. And
of course, many people in a lot of those industries, for example, might be relatively low paid. Tips is an important part of their income. And then, of course, you have the charities where they might not be able to do the traditional during restrictions, collection. But as you say, that they have collection points. And if people don't have the cash on them, they can't give it.
No, exactly. And actually, on the charity side, it was around about the time of the annual campaign, the 65 Roses campaign for Cystic Fibrosis Ireland. And that would be their biggest event of the year. And they had to cancel it. The cash collection went to zero. So
what did you decide to do about it?
Well, I thought, OK, this is a massive problem. The big guys, the traditional kind of payment providers, don't seem to be doing anything. I wasn't entirely sure if it could be done. So I reached out to a leading payments technology expert in Ireland. And I said, look, I think there's a huge problem here. And he said, oh, I've noticed it. There definitely is a problem. And I said, do you think it could be done, fixed this way? And he said, let me look at it and I'll get back to you. And he got back the next day and said three things. He said, not only do I think that's possible, I think it's patentable and I'll quit my job right away and join you if you want to do it.
And so what, is it based then on the idea, let's say, for example, the person who might get a tip, you want to give them a tip, who delivers food to your door, are they carrying a little chip or a device, or are they just even carrying like a QR code, or what do they need?
It's a mixture. We've got lots of different versions. In some cases, it is a little bit of hardware, which is so small, you can have it in a lapel pin or a wristband. In many cases, we people wearing them around their neck on lanyards.
And have you managed to patent it, Ollie, yet?
Yeah, so we filed a global patent in the US, actually, at Christmas. And the reason we did it in the US is because it gives you global protection. And also, it's the biggest tipping market. So, and we're moving it. We've one client who's actually bringing us into the US now in 30 locations.
So for people who are going to get these tips, do people tend to tip more if you're tipping using an electronic device instead of cash?
Not only are they tipping more, they're also tipping higher amounts, actually. And also, there's a few things that surprised us, a few learnings we've had from this. Actually, one is the different amount that people tip in different places. Pre-COVID, the average tip on the north side was around €2 for a delivery, a food delivery takeaway. And on the south side, it was €1.50.
Right. Doesn't surprise me at all. As somebody who was born on the north side.
So people definitely more generous on the north side. But what also happened then is when we implemented Strike and people were able to tip digitally, the tips went up significantly to closer to €4, nearly double the amount.
Does it cost then, for example, if I'm using it, if I'm the person, the delivery person, does it cost me money then to receive the tips this way?
Generally nothing at all, actually.
So who do you make your money from?
Yeah, so there's a transaction fee, like any payment, when you use your card in the shop. Over 90% of people, when they're giving a tip, €5 or something, will accept the fees. They want the person to get the €5. Over 98% of people accept the fees when it's to a charity. And it's instant. So if you make a donation to Cystic Fibrosis Ireland, for instance, in the past, it used to take them weeks before they'd see that, because they'd have to, you know, have people collecting the cash and then counting it and then converting it to usable electronic funds. And in that process, there was some loss as well. So we've taken that process, which in some cases was kind of 10, 12 weeks, when people make a donation to the charity, now it goes straight to them.
And we were moving away from cash anyway. And do you think then that the pandemic has just accelerated that? Are we heading for a cashless society?
No, we were gradually, and Sweden is pretty much almost there. Most countries, including Ireland, weren't expected to be there for at least another 10 years. So it's accelerated by a decade or so.
And the potential market for this is international, global, really, isn't it? It's a big market.
Absolutely, yeah. And so the numbers I gave you earlier were just English-speaking countries and just the tipping market alone. We reckon around 60 million users. Charity is a different, obviously, scenario, a different setup, but we have, so between the charities that we're working with now, we have orders for about 5,000 strike tags.
And do you need to raise money, more investments?
Yes, we need to run. So we closed a seed round. And we got back in from high net worth Irish and American tech investors and Enterprise Ireland, actually, who were fantastic. They supported us very, very quickly from the beginning. When I first had the idea, it's less than a year ago, they approved us in 8 days for our first
kind of funding. And much did you raise, Ollie?
So we set out to raise for just over 300,000, and we stopped taking money at 600,000.
In terms of your own background, you were born in... Raised in Strabane.
Yes, yeah. I was born in Borneo in Malaysia. My parents were working out there, and then we moved to Strabane.
Were you very young when you went to Strabane from Borneo? Memories of Borneo, have you?
No. I think it was close to three, yeah.
And Strabane, were your parents from there originally?
No, my mum's from Monkstown in Dublin. My dad's from Derry, actually. And so his practice, he is a GP in Strabane. That's where he ended up.
And what was it like growing up in Strabane? Would it have been a bit of a hotspot in the Troubles?
It was very much a hotspot at the time. It had the highest unemployment in Europe. Obviously, the Troubles were ongoing. I didn't spend too much time there. Every day that we weren't in school, we were either down here in Dublin or off in other places. So our parents got us out of there as much as they could.
Yeah, I was going to say, were you someone who had your eye on getting out of there and getting away from all of that and saying, look, first chance I get, I'm gone?
Yeah, I guess I was kind of starry-eyed for the big smoke. So the day I finished my exams, I went straight to London, actually. And I was in England for a few years, university there, and then university in France. And then I went to California for a few years and then came back here and made my home in Dublin.
And in terms of the family and your parents and brothers and sisters, you all experienced really terrible personal loss.
Yes, well, cystic fibrosis is in the family. We didn't know about it until my siblings were born. It wasn't something that had been known in the family. And obviously, it's genetic. There's a chance, I think it's a 1 in 20 chance that two carriers might meet. That happened to be my parents. And so they had a number of children with CF. Yeah. Three of whom died at a young age.
How young were they when they died, your brothers and sisters?
My first brother, and he was a couple of weeks old, so I never met him. Then my sister was born, Aisling, and she clear, totally, you know, healthy. And then I was born, same. And then I had a younger sister, Rachel, who was born. She lived till she was four. And then I had a brother, John, who actually was born without CF, but he did die due to other reasons. He had umbilical cord actually was attached around his neck. And then the youngest girl, Sorsha, she was 3 months when she died.
Do you have recollections then of...
I remember Rachel, who was four, because I was six at the time. And but apart from her, no, not really.
The impact that must have had on your parents, I mean, it's an extraordinary, difficult level of loss for anyone to even contemplate.
Huge. Yeah, when I think about it now, I'm kind of just amazed, you know, how they pulled through it so well. It really was... We were quite sheltered, myself and my sister Ashley, and it wasn't a massive... traumatic, you know, years of trauma in the family. We didn't really notice it. They kept us quite sheltered from it. But for them, obviously, it must have been horrendous.
But for them, not only to try to deal with it and to get through it, but then also to be able to shelter you from it.
Yeah, they're very strong. They did an amazing job. Yeah.
And did it affect the family in the wider sense, in terms of the impact that it had on you?
It's hard to say. I mean, I don't. It must have, but my honest answer is that I didn't see it. It like this looming, you know, big dark grey cloud over us all the time. Actually, we had a happy childhood.
And your sister Rachel, what do you remember of her?
I remember her playing in the garden. I remember her wearing. She used to wear this all-in-one red. What are those things called that the kids wear? It's kind of a like a one-piece cozy suit, and I just remember her running around in that, and she was a happy child. But every day she would have to have her back padded, which my dad did. That was his thing. Had to be done with children in order to clear their lungs, and you know, so most of the time I think you know, I saw her, she was having that done to her. That was obviously a big thing.
And you were named Ollie. Your brother who died, your older brother who died, he was Ollie.
He was Oliver, yeah. But the same name ultimately, yeah, it's a name that's in the family. That we're there's a claim that we're descendants of sixth generations descended from St. Oliver Plunkett. So it's the name is in the family, yeah.
Do you find yourself thinking a lot about the family that you've lost, about, you know, brother and sisters, that how things might have been different?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I wonder what it'd be like to have a brother, you know, for instance, or to, you know, to have other siblings. And you know, with two of us, it was a nice, happy childhood. We always got everything we wanted, so a nice unit. But I do wonder what it would have been like to have more. Rachel, who was four, was the only one who kind of lived to an age where she had a personality, and she was a lovely child. She was adored. She was gorgeous and funny, and in spite of, you know, constantly being in and out of hospital.
In terms of business, Ollie, you have set up a number of companies, haven't you? You've done and quite different things.
Yeah, I had a couple of other tech companies that I sold on, and a couple of others that didn't make it. So mixed bag, but mostly decent, successful companies.
What one didn't? What didn't make it?
Actually, the one that I really regret that didn't make it was a company I started in 2006. Called Pliba, which stood for Please Let It Be Available. And it was a mobile booking portal. And this is pre-iPhone. And no one was booking things in their phone. Nothing. So we were first, we did the first car rental booking on the mobile in Europe. We did the first taxi booking on mobile in Ireland. Restaurants, all of these things now that today you would actually have an app for. You would have, you know, the Bolt app for your taxi or Uber or something.
And you had developed it, you had it up and running.
We had all of this before any of these other apps.
Were you now too early, or yeah, what went wrong?
Absolutely. We ran out of money before the iPhone was launched, and the iPhone fixed all our problems.
And what was the gap between closing it and the time being right for that to commercially take off? Because in a sense, everybody's doing it now, and you've got these multi-billion dollar businesses, yeah, like Uber or whatever else that are built on this.
Yeah, so we did with two things that would kind of work slightly against us. One was the timing, it was a bit too early, but and the other was, and this is a life lesson, this is a big lesson in business I learned the hard way, is trying to do too many things and not focusing on just focus on one thing and do it really, really, really well. And if that one thing had been, let's say, just taxi booking or booking a restaurant, or booking a hotel. But we tried to do all of those. We had 52,000 different services on Pliba. And so we wanted to everyone to book everything through it. And so we were kind of jack of all trades and, you know, master of none.
If you could have hung on, how long would you have had to wait for the iPhone? You know, what was that gap?
Oh, it was, so it was probably less than a year.
Really?
But by then we'd moved, you know, we'd moved on. And
you could be sitting on billions.
Yeah. Well, actually, interestingly, there's one other massive thing that got away during that time. We noticed that a lot of people were using our product for something that it wasn't designed for at all. And that was chat. We had built in a chat feature, but it was just to help with the bookings. And we noticed that people were using it just to chat to each other. And so they're actually using it like WhatsApp. And
so that could have been something.
Well, on hindsight, if we had thought, actually, you know, forget all this other stuff that people aren't using, just drop it. Let's just, you know, expand on the chat side and let people use this as a chat app, then yeah.
You mentioned there about a lesson learned vis-a-vis don't do too many things. Other lessons that you've learned from your experience in business?
Commit early, which means take a risk, quit your job and go for it full on. So you have no choice but to survive. With Pliba, myself and my co-founder Frank Friel, we stayed in our other jobs. You know, I wonder if we had really committed properly earlier and took that plunge by quitting our jobs, we might have actually made it work.
And with Strike, it's a very good, sharp, simple name, and it only has one letter different to $100 billion Irish business Stripe. Which is in payments as well.
Well, they're a partner of ours. Actually, we work with them. The reason that we got our name is a logical thing. It's strike is the motion you make with your phone when you're tapping or striking your phone. They got their name because of the stripe in the back of your credit card, I think. Yeah, they're kind of close, but quite different. You know,
what do you think you'd do if they came over the hill with a large check and said they'd like to buy Strike?
Well, that's part of the reason that. We kind of stayed in stealth mode, as they call it, or kind of under wraps for a while we're working on our patent application. We thought, you know, one of the bigger players is probably going to realize that actually there's a big market there that they're not addressing. And an easy way to get into it is through acquisition of, you know, someone who's actually got traction and proven that they can do it, you know.
Well, Ollie Kavanagh of Strike, thank you very much for joining us on the program.
Thank you very much.